kicky music, that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Trey Graham, sitting in for Linda Holmes, who's on vacation. Today, we are going to take advantage of a certain governator's new memoir to talk about the evolution of the action hero. We will turn our attention after that to a different kind of hero, by which I mean the very thing in the logo of our show, the Noble Cocktail. And as always, we will wrap up with a quick round of what's making us happy this week. First, though, the introductions. Who are you, sir, here at my left elbow?
I am Stephen Thompson. I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And you, sir, on my right, in the natty tweeds.
Oh, you turned my head. My name is Glenn Weldon, and I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Awesome. Now, as I said, Linda Holmes is on vacation, so we have recruited a fill-in, and a very appropriate one, because like the action hero, Sylvester Stallone, he knows a little something about the boxing. Chris Klimek, tell us a bit about what you do.
Hi, I'm a writer about town for the Washington Post and the Washington City Paper, and when I'm lucky, for the Monkey See blog.
You may remember Chris Klimek from such previous Pop Culture Happy Hours as the one where we talked about Real Steel.
And robot boxing.
Robot boxing.
Indeed. So as we said, Arnold Schwarzenegger has a new memoir out. It is called Total Recall, although I bet he doesn't. Obviously, I have not read this book, but Chris, you have at least cracked it, right?
Yeah, I'm about halfway through.
All right, so what's striking you so far?
The fact that he did scene work with Lucille Ball.
Really?
That is not a thing I knew.
That's not a thing
Tell
that
me
I knew
more.
Either. Yeah, for a television special called Happy Anniversary and Goodbye, also starring Art Carney.
I am Nico.
Oh, yes. We want you to all you are in.
Where are we doing?
What?
Here or in the bedroom?
Oh, here.
Carney! Schwarzenegger! Bah!
He's in The Expendables, too, I think. Also.
Oh, awesome, yes. So there must be something that is sort of emerging as a theme in the early chapters.
Well, before we get to that, I mean, this kind of project could go in one of two ways, which is either so over the top and kind of sleazy that he could just kind of get the sense that he's a pig, or it's been so scrubbed clean by image consultants that it's nothing but it was a pleasure to work with James Earl Jones. And that's it.
Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't a movie Nazi.
No. It's all of a piece.
The coverage I've seen of this is that he is, in fact, fairly direct about some of his failings, including the unfortunate business with the housekeeper and the child and letting the wife down, but that he's not dwelling on it.
Compartmentalizes
it.
Most memoirs, the book is chronological, and of course that would be the later chapters where we get to the scandal with the housekeeper. We're in the middle of the production of Conan the Barbarian in 1981 right now. So this is still the era that came under a lot of scrutiny when he was running for governor in California in 2003 when I lived there. So I had kind of a front row seat for that. But it's probably falling more towards the latter of Glenn's two choices there. There's mostly it's a tale of a hardworking immigrant who would not be denied his dreams and self-determination.
Well, sure. It's in a tricky spot. I mean, Arnold Schwarzenegger is in a tricky spot, which is to say, on one hand, he's been in all these silly action movies and has presumably done all sorts of untoward and massively entertaining things, but he's also a politician. And he's been a politician for long enough now that it seems like it would be fairly deeply ingrained. I'm not going to do my Schwarzenegger. I mean, I might during the course of this conversation.
Do it at some point.
But it would just be Rainier Wolfcastle.
Yeah, right.
Stephen doing Rainier Wolfcastle doing Arnold Schwarzenegger.
And that is irritating. So I it's good that you recognize the fine distinction between the genuine article and...
Chris, is it an easy read? Are there a lot of 10-shilling words? Is it tough to get through?
Well, there are fewer than there are in Joseph Anton, the Rushdie memoir that I'm kind of reading in tandem with it.
Dude, that is a chore you've set yourself there.
Well, I don't know. I have yet to actually finish a Rushdie novel. I mean, I've read his short fiction and his nonfiction, and it's not because I don't enjoy it or I find it too homeworky. Yes, Total Recall is an easy read.
It's a weird tandem you're working on there. So Schwarzenegger belonged to this class. He bestrode the action film alongside Sylvester Stallone in the 80s, like twin colossi.
Yes, indeed.
Like two pumped-up mountains of flank steak. Who looked more like balloon animals than anything else. But if you put them in a continuum, you have in the, and I'm sure I'm going to be sort of leading a lot of things here, but in the 60s and 70s, you had wiry guys.
Right.
You had Steve
Eastwood.
McQueen and your Eastwoods, who would get into some fisticuffs every so often, but they was mostly about shooting people and chasing people in cars. Nowadays, you have very physical hand-to-hand combatants like Jason Bourne and Ethan Hunt in the Mission Impossible films.
They have, with possibly the exception of Ethan Hunt, they have layers. They got layers now.
Yeah.
Well, I think that goes back to a larger point, I think, about the type of actors we're talking about.
Yep.
And it seems to me that when people think of the prototypical action hero, it's very easy, particularly in the age group that we're more or less all in, it's very easy to think of the action movie as being an 80s phenomenon.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But that's really the era in which you have the pumped up flank steak. I mean, other than like a Charles Bronson,
sure.
You know, most of, like you said, the early guys are wiry. But now what I notice about the different actors who sort of fall under the category of action heroes, looking at the list, what do Matt Damon, Samuel L. Jackson, Hugh Jackman, Tom Cruise, even Jason Statham, what do they have in common? They're not Jean-Claude Van Damme. They're not cheesy. They're like awardsy.
Yeah, this is what I'm talking about. This latter generation, they're actors with some chops. They bring more craft than we generally would sort of expect from an 80s action movie this work.
I mean, even though Matt Damon is the star of one of the big action franchises of the last 10, 15 years, he's not a meathead.
Right. Well, he can do other things. And that was sort of the distinguishing feature of the stars of the 80s action films that I really liked. I mean, I saw the Schwarzenegger films. The ones that I liked, I mostly preferred because of who directed them. I mean, Total Recall and the mm-hmm. two Terminator films that James Cameron made. You know, I didn't just follow him in anything. But, you know, by 1987, 1988, there's this whole second wave that included Lethal Weapon and mm-hmm. Die Hard and, you know, Mel Gibson and Danny Glover. Of course, we've had some unwelcome revelations about Mel Gibson since then, but these are actors clearly capable of doing other things.
Yeah,
same
sure.
thing with Bruce Willis.
Sure.
And I felt like the fact that those characters had a little more humanity made those films, which were still exciting and viscerally appealing, well,
okay, so
better films.
We've talked about the 80s, we've talked about the 90s and the early 2000s, and we've touched a little bit on the earlier films, the 60s films with your McQueens and your
Eastwoods.
What we haven't done is touch on the action hero, who's James Bond, who has survived over 50 years and sort of had variations in each of these periods. And even he had precursors in the films of Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to talk a little bit about that continuum. Let's focus particularly on the changing aspects of Bond. Because they track, right?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it's a circle. You had Connery, who was a brutish, not loutish, but a very physical, brutish kind of Bond. Then
he was a bodybuilder.
He was a bodybuilder as well. And then you get into the dandy era of right. Roger Moore, who became, because he kept in the part so long, he became your kind of well-dressed uncle by the time he was done.
And he was actually older than Connery was, even though he, you know, inherited the part. So I think he was already in his 40s the first time he played it.
And it looks it. Looking back now, you can kind of see it. Dalton played Burnt Out, which is something we hadn't seen in Bond before. So he doesn't get the credit I think he's due. Brosnan was merely thin, as far as I'm concerned.
Thin with good hair.
I mean, I think Brosnan sort of falls into the category a little bit of the dandy, sleek action hero, which is different from the more muscular sort.
And now we're back to it with Craig. I mean, I see a lot of similarities between, I think everybody does, between Connery and Craig. There's this physicality to them that the part's been missing for a long time.
And the brooding again.
And the brooding.
Well, I'm very curious to see where Skyfall, the James Bond film that's due out in a month or so, will fall along the spectrum, because I've really, really enjoyed the reboot that's been spread over the latter two movies.
Mm-hmm.
The last one was the first direct continuation in the history of the series. And we still don't know whether the absence of quips that were present even in the Connery film, certainly by Goldfinger, the third film, you know, he's saying shocking after he's thrown a lamp into a bathtub and electrocuted a guy and things like that.
Ice to see you.
Well, that's I've got it written down here. Allow me to break the ice. Let's kick some ice. The Iceman cometh. I mean, that's over the line.
You don't get to quote
Eugene O'Neill. That's not bad. But your point about the quip, I mean, in the 80s, the catchphrase sort of ossified into this cliche, this whole notion of camera dollies in, soundtrack cuts out, somebody says something dumb, then big explosion. That became, especially back to the Stallone films and certainly the Schwarzenegger films, that became the rallying thing. But it was so contrived. It was so focus grouped. It didn't feel like something like Yippie-Ki-Yay Emmer Effer in Die Hard, which wasn't a quip, which wasn't, I mean, it was a quip, but right, it wasn't a catchphrase. It wasn't engineered.
The best catchphrases happen accidentally. I mean, Arnold actually does talk a little bit in the book about getting into a fight with during an argument with James Cameron on the set of The Terminator, because he's arguing that because the Terminator is a machine, he should say, "I will be back," absent the contraction, because that is more machine-like. And Cameron is saying, "Yeah, I wrote the script. No, just trust me."
Fun.
Because and that's the,
yeah, right. But I think you have a point there in that the best catchphrases seem like they occur naturally. Something I want to say about this, just because the Dirty Harry catchphrase, "Make my day," came in for some scrutiny following the Republican National Convention and, you know, Clint Eastwood's appearance there. This is probably the most famous Dirty Harry catchphrase. Dirty Harry has the unique distinction of having a different catchphrase in each film. He doesn't sustain one through his 5-film crime-fighting career. And "Make My Day" does not come along until the 4th Dirty Harry movie in 1983.
Let's talk a little bit about the various genres or subgenres of action films. You got your straight-ahead Rambos, man out for revenge, but then you've got action comedies. You've got sort of tongue-in-cheek parodies of action comedies where they're working the tropes, and you've got futuristic action movies. You've got sci-fi action movies. You've sure. got the evolution from the beefcake into the interstellar lady fighting action movie with the Alien series. Glenn Weldon, what's your favorite subgenre or example?
Well, my example kind of picks up on this whole catchphrase topic, because RoboCop, now Chris has a savant-like ability to be able to name the year that a movie came out.
1987.
Wow. RoboCop was satirizing these cliches even as these cliches were still sort of floating around mm-hmm. in the ether. Because it has, in that movie, a catchphrase, "I'll buy that for a dollar." And it's making fun of the fact that there's a catchphrase. But that film also contains a climactic scene in which the main character says something, and there's a big explosion at the very, very end. The words he says is, "Thank you." And that caused the biggest reaction in the theater I have ever seen of just people standing up and cheering. Because uh-huh. it's not about the phrasing of the catchphrase. It's about building up to it yeah. legitimately, moment. To yeah. a moment, emotionally, and then giving the audience that release. So as for my money, RoboCop's the best action movie of all time. Well, up there with Starship Troopers.
Stephen Thompson.
Well, and sort of a companion to RoboCop, looking at the same director, Paul Verhoeven, is Starship Troopers, mm-hmm. where, you know, so much of what that director does is these layers of meta. And I can see, I'm not surprised, looking across the table at Glenn Weldon, that would be your pick. I think it's interesting when we look at sort of subgenres of action movie, how much of, like, the 80s pictures, and, you know, talking about Mel Gibson in particular, how much mm-hmm. of them delve into sort of an early ancestor of torture porn? And how much of the way Mel Gibson in particular is treated in, like, the Lethal Weapon movies, where, like, watching him tortured and pummeled, I mean, John McClane in Die Hard falls into that category somewhat, but the kind of Christ-like journey of these action heroes in which they are, you know, they have all these torments visited upon them.
Right. And I feel like that kind of reaches its apex in 24. Kiefer Sutherland is this grim, suffering guy. Never a quip from him. You know, all he does is take it and take it and shout and look more and more unhappy.
Man.
But no, you're right. Lethal Weapon, the first time we meet Mel Gibson's character, Martin Riggs, he is weeping, looking at a picture of his dead wife, and he has his gun in his mouth. And this is before the bad guys even start wailing.
This is true.
Exactly. I mean, there's certainly more suffering in some than in others. And again, speaking of suffering, you kind of breezed past Alien.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't think we should leave out the number of action movies in which women kick ass, continuing yeah. on through Angelina Jolie and Salt. Mm-hmm. And who can forget Kathleen Turner in V.I. Warshaw?
Who can forget Kathleen Turner in Romancing the Stone, although she's not doing much of the ass-kicking. But I would say one really big divider between these kinds of things and torture porn is that torture porn is really just about sadism.
Right.
And you're right. These characters are Christ figures. They are standing in for the rest of us, taking the evils of the world upon them.
Right.
So let's talk about how Tom Cruise runs funny.
Runs
like a foal. Runs like he just read a book about running and thinks, "Hey, I should try this out sometime."
For me, it's all about the way the elbows go.
It's weird.
Yeah. You know?
Daniel Craig, one of his essential qualifications to be Bond is that he is a lot more physical than prior incarnations. He, in fact, does more running in the first 10 minutes of Casino Royale than Roger Moore did in 7 movies.
Yeah, that's true. That amazing sort of free-running parkour sequence mm-hmm. that opened that movie, I think people need to go back and watch that again on the YouTube. So have we exhausted the possibilities of action hero?
Well, we haven't. I mean, obviously, we could talk
the
about
evolution.
We could
the
talk about Errol Flynn. We could talk about generation upon generation upon generation of action hero. We're of course leaving a zillion out, and I would recommend that people go to our Facebook page.
I think that is a thing that should happen. Yes, come to the Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us about your favorite action hero, your favorite catchphrase, your favorite running and jumping sequence. Again, facebook.com/PCHH. We are going to move on and talk about our favorite thing about the Bond movies, which is its iconic treatment of the cocktail. We're actually, of course, going to talk a little more broadly about the role of cocktails in pop culture at large, starting with, I think, the non-plus-ultra of cocktail culture in the Thin Man movies. Nick and Nora Charles, the great detectives of the Thin Man movies, are constantly crocked. How many other high-functioning alcoholics have we seen starring in caper comedies?
Caper comedies, I don't know, but I mean, we have been, as a culture, singing the praises of alcohol since sea shanties and drinking songs and How Dry I Am, and you know, people were getting all excited about absinthe back in La Belle Époque, back in Paris.
As I recall, the Greeks had a thing with wine
they
in the
did.
Theater.
They did, absolutely. So you got The Big Lebowski and White Russians, you got Sex and the City and Cosmos, you got certainly Bond and Martinis, which I always thought was a vodka martini, but that's actually not true. Technically, it's a three-part Gordon's, one part vodka, one part Lillet. And shaken,
okay,
of course,
then.
Not stirred.
Shaken, not
stirred. Romulan ale from Star Trek?
of course.
Outlawed.
Is it?
It Complete, is.
Yes, it is outlawed. Yeah. It makes you do bad things.
Yeah, in Wrath of Khan, when Kirk gets an illicit bottle of it from Bones for his birthday, he says so.
You are correct, sir.
Okay.
Doesn't all alcohol make you do bad things if you drink enough of it?
The Scotch on Mad Men, Duff Beer for me, Duff Beer for you from The Simpsons, Pinot Noir from the film Sideways, of course. But there is an insidious effect that depictions of alcohol have on the impressionable minds, because if I were a kid and I watched Justified and I saw these people sitting around sipping bourbon like they do, I would be in. I would do some kind of cross-state crime because it looks so awesome.
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting. You listed all these different drinks and sort of how they fit these different characters. Well, what they have in common in every one of those cases is that they're shorthand for a personality type.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, a cosmopolitan, you know, sort of urban women, you know, Duff Beer, Homer Simpson, you know, these different types where it's, you know, the martinis, sort of this, you know, high class swank, you know, strolling through a casino or whatever. And so very often alcohol, as much as it's celebrated throughout the history of popular culture, is really almost its primary function, its primary function in our lives, but its primary function in popular culture is to serve as a sturdy metaphor for everything from class and distinction to despair to celebration, of course. I mean, when you get into music,
if you're carrying the martini glass through the casino, then you're on top of your game. If you're sitting slumped in a chair with a glass of brown liquor and a cigarette, it's a whole different story.
Just the sheer volume of classic country music drinking songs. I mean, I'll start talking about great drinking songs in a second. But if you really look all the way through most of these examples, when we can name examples, it's because they say something about the characters that drink them.
And that is a well-recognized, even hacky writing exercise. When you're kind of listing things about this character, you're creating a character, you're going from the outside in. What is their signature cocktail? What do they drink? What do they have in their hand? Gets to exactly what you're saying. It's a way to kind of synthesize a lot of different things about the character.
Interesting. Let's talk about cocktails in comedy in particular, because the one line that always comes to mind when I think of people who are drinking too much is from the women, "Get me a bromide and put some gin in it." This is spoken by a character who is in some distress because she's just found out that her husband is, you know, cheating on her again. But what opportunities does alcohol provide in comedies?
Well, it's a vehicle for slapstick.
Yep.
I mean, it's the lubricant of slapstick in a lot of ways. I mean, you think of, you know, throughout history of kind of the cad sort of falling down and doing all sorts of, you know, I mean, Dudley Moore and Arthur or you know, or W.C. Fields.
It's also single-handedly responsible for transforming the real world from this weird, tiny, little, very contrived sociological experiment to debauchery. To just nothing but pure debauchery, just watching teenagers go at each other in a hot tub.
Oh, you're actually talking about the real world, the TV show. I thought you were talking about the actual world we inhabit.
Do you want me to do that again with MTVs?
No, I would argue, too, that it's the thing that transforms great comedies into sad little tragedies. Like, you talk about Arthur. Arthur's got a bittersweet, sad quality underlying it, that his his excesses come at a real cost.
Yeah, I mean, Arthur certainly understands that it's, you know, that it's not all comedy at the end of that road. Whereas a show like Cheers, you know, where alcohol is obviously integral to it, it's kind of swept aside a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Norm, sad man.
Chris Klimek, we get some of that in the latest Bond movies too, right? The pivot from urbane to really wrecked, driven by emotions, driven by the real-life consequences of what his job is, but alcohol is the pivot.
Yeah, that's right. One of the few big laughs in Casino Royale is when Bond goes over and orders a martini and the bartender asks if he'd like it shaken or stirred, and he says, "Do I look like I give a damn?" But, you know, we do see him drinking alone, which is not unprecedented in the franchise, but in that particular film I'm thinking of, you know, he's just had to excuse himself from the poker table, and in the interim, he's killed two guys in a fist fight in a stairwell, and we actually see his hand shaking a little bit, and you know, he swallows a whole tumbler of I don't know if it was bourbon or what, you know, looking himself in the mirror, washing the blood off of his shirt. I mean, this is not the jaunty.
This is not
cocked eyebrow Roger Moore, exactly.
Yeah, you get a little bit of the downside there. Well, you know, you were talking, Glenn, earlier about RoboCop, and we mentioned Starship Troopers. You know, another action movie, lest we forget, throwing back to action movies, is Team America World Police, which has that scene.
A very expansive definition of action.
Wow.
That is an action movie. And there's that, one of the biggest, cheapest laughs in the movie is, you know, where the character goes into the bar and he's drinking and drinking and drinking. And then you have this extended scene where for like 90 seconds, they just hook a hose up to the puppet as it vomits, you know, prolifically in an alley. So, you know, it's certainly a, you know, par for the course. As much as alcohol is glamorized, you usually see some trace of the downside.
Well, Stephen, music can capture both sides of that. Tends to dwell, I think, more on the downside of that. I mean, I think the polka, if not created because of beer, certainly benefits from it. It's a joyous dance, but there's certainly a lot of sort of, as you were saying.
Are you finding the winsome underbelly of the beer barrel polka?
I am.
In heaven there is no beer, that's why we drink it here. That was a staple. And,
why, Stephen, do you roll out the barrel? To get the blues on the run. My very point.
You drink to forget.
You drink to forget. But, I mean, I can't speak to country music, but certainly in hip-hop, yes, you both can. In hip-hop, Cristal and 40s are a big thing.
Gin and hip-hop juice. Being much more your wheelhouse.
Yes, exactly. Right. But what do you think? Like, name some songs that kind of tackle this.
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, going back to the kind of alcohol as sturdy metaphor for everything, I mean, the two sort of pillars of alcohol in song, to me, just off the top of my head, are despair and celebration.
Yeah.
You know, where on one hand you have, you know, there's a tear in my beer and sort of the complete collected works of George Jones.
Sure.
And the songs from the perspective of the guy at the bar with his head kind of resting on the rail. And then you have, certainly in hip-hop, you know, your Gin and Juice, and you mentioned Cristal, because I know it's our world. But, you know, but also, even in country, you've got your Friends in Low Places, and you've got a lot of kind of drinking anthems and your kind of barroom sing-alongs.
Your Margaritavilles.
Sure.
Margaritavilles. Well, but I mean, you're wasting away in Margaritaville.
Right, true.
And of course, the two are actually not as far apart. Look at Friends in Low Places, where the whiskey drowns and the beer chases my blues away.
Right.
But at
root, that's a breakup song.
Right. The more I think about it, the more I think I can get behind these celebration songs.
Well, it's certainly those two genres, the, you know, hip-hop and country, where the drinking songs seem to dominate. But my favorite Frank Sinatra album is actually Only the Lonely, one with you know, One More for My Baby and One More for
Sure,
the
Road. Sure,
yeah. Which is
terrible thought.
A sentiment that
we do not endorse.
Right, the album that he wanted to call One for the Losers over the objections of Capitol Records. And I guess he lost that fight.
Wonder why.
I'd have bought it.
So aside from just laying out the parameters, do we have specific song recommendations that we want to talk about?
I got one. And, you know, I was going through lists of drinking songs in preparation because I'm nothing if not a studious researcher. And the song that jumped out as probably my favorite drinking song of all time, it's an old Webb Pierce song called There Stands the Glass. And there's a cover of it that I really want to call attention to from an album that I absolutely loved from about 20 years ago called The Next 100 Years by a singer named Ted Hawkins.
Okay.
And if you're not familiar with Ted Hawkins, he was kind of discovered late in life. He was a busker who would sing on boardwalks and stuff, and so he's got that sand on his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And he does a cover of this song, There Stands the Glass, that is just absolutely gorgeous. And, you know, it really brings out the poetry in Drunken Misery the way I like it.
There stands a glass that will drown all my fears, that will hide all my tears. Brother, I'm on my way.
And you said it's There Stands the Glass, right?
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Chris Klimek, what you got?
Off the top of my head, my drinking song recommendation would be Drive-By Truckers' Women Without Whiskey. Mm-hmm. There are two great singer-songwriters in this band, Patterson Hood and Mike Cooley. Cooley is the less prolific one, but I think pound for pound, the more reliable songwriter. And Women Without Whiskey definitely falls in the more despairing end of the drinking song spectrum that we've identified. This is a ballad from a guy who recognizes what his drinking is about to cost him and isn't sure that he can stop, even with the recognition that this is going to be a hugely costly addiction at this point. Whiskey's hard to beat, as he says in the song.
All right, let's hear a little bit of that.
If I make it through this year, I think I'm gonna put this bottle down. I guess as time goes on, I'll grow to miss it less than I will now. I think I'm gonna tell her that I'm gonna go away for a while, till I can get this demon out.
Women Without Whiskey.
Awesome. Glenn Weldon.
Geez, I got nothing, because, you know, alcohol's depressant. And so these two songs sort of hit that thing. So I figure I'll go the other direction with a little ditty called Knees Up, Mother Brown. This is a pub song. It's happy.
It is a pub song.
You're acting like a jerk.
I'm surprised.
This is the other side of alcohol.
Wow, nice.
Acting like a jerk with lots of people.
All right, Knees Up, Mother Brown. Here we go.
Knees up, Mother Brown. Knees up, Mother Brown. Come along, dearie, let it go. E-I-E-I-E-I-O. It's your bloomin' birthday. Let's wake up all the town. So knees up, don't get a breeze up. Knees up, Mother Brown.
I'm just glad you didn't recommend the national anthem, which is, after all, in case you don't know, based on an old English drinking song.
Ah, yeah.
You guys have already done Fairy Tale of New York on this show.
That's
right?
Absolutely
yes,
right.
We have. Yes, we have. And I'm just going to go back to one I mentioned a couple of weeks ago in the breakup song segment and say, she's acting single, I'm drinking doubles.
God bless it.
She's acting single.
And that I think is going to have to be it for alcohol and pop culture for us. Come tell us about your own interpretations of these things at the Facebook page or at the blog. It's facebook.com/PCHH.
And recommend some drinking songs.
Yes, absolutely. And that brings us to the final segment of every show, which is what's making us happy this week. I'm going to throw first to Glenn Weldon. Let's go back around the other way.
There's a comedy podcast, hold on, hear me out, that we really should have mentioned, I really should have mentioned during our Canadian content. Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Yes.
This is called Stop Podcasting Yourself with Graham Clark and Dave Shumka.
You have mentioned this one before.
I don't know if I have. I think I might have mentioned it to you privately. But
sometimes we speak separately from the show.
He mentioned it to you on The Real World.
That's right. It's great. It's funny. And for a long time I've been listening, and for a long time they've had a segment every week called Hulk Hogan News. And some weeks you're kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel.
Oh, but
with
not
Hulk
this
Hogan
week.
News.
Not this week.
This week, and I'm sure many in the NPR demo have not deigned to find out why today was a particularly big, well, not so big, medium-sized event in Hulk Hogan News. But just go to Gawker, type Hulk Hogan News, you'll figure it out. So in a way, this segment has been building up to this very moment. And yet, because this is such a good, smart, funny show, they approach it with a certain amount of distaste, and they zig when they could zag. So they have a really interesting, very funny take on this whole thing.
This unfortunate situation that Mr. Hogan finds himself in.
Exactly. So I recommend the podcast. I recommend this particular episode of the podcast, but the podcast in general. Stop podcasting yourself.
All right.
And I forgot to mention that Hulk Hogan is my favorite action hero, starring in Mr. Nanny.
That's
awesome.
Right.
All right, Chris Klimek.
The Mr. Nanny franchise went downhill after the first one.
Indeed.
I think.
Chris Klimek, what's making you happy this week?
Okay, so about a month ago, as this airs, Bruce Springsteen played a sold-out Nationals stadium, and I was right there on the island nation of Cyprus, not even in the USA, into which Bruce and also myself were famously born. However, last weekend was the 25th anniversary of what is, in my opinion, the last beginning-to-end great Bruce Springsteen album, Tunnel of Love.
That's a great record.
This is one that time has not forgotten, but he didn't play anything from it during the 3.5 hours that he was on stage at National Stadium. Wow. You know, it made a big impression when it came out. It beat out the Joshua Tree and other big records from the Rolling Stone Critics Poll in 1987. Had some fairly big singles off of it, Brilliant Disguise, One Step Up. But, you know, this is not an album that is well remembered. But I can tell you now that the 25th anniversary reissue does not exist. And it should. It should. Like I said, I think it's his last beginning-to-end great record. This is the more interior Bruce. This is really the only album that he devotes in its entirety to sort of the tension in relationships. He tried to revisit this territory less fruitfully in the 90s with Human Touch and Lucky Town. This one, along with Nebraska, the choice that the Pitchfork crowd is forever citing, are my two favorite Bruce Springsteen records. I think this one is the lesser known of the two. So.
How do you feel about the production on that record?
The production sounds like it came out in 1987. There's a lot of synthesizers and stuff, but I think the songs are...
The songs are great. I mean, I think Brilliant Disguise is one of his best songs.
I agree.
So it's the fact that the reissue does not exist?
No, there is no reissue.
Okay,
what I'm saying is...
I'm trying to figure out how this is making
you happy. You saw Bruce Springsteen in concert.
No, didn't see that either. just revisiting this album on the occasion of its 25th birthday is making me happy, and, you know, realizing that this is a guy with... Well, I think people know that he has more facets than the bandana. But
there is that. Now, you had a second thing?
The second thing, briefly, is a book I read. This is the 1974 sci-fi novel, The Forever War. This is kind of a classic. It won the Hugo, it won the Nebula, it won all the sci-fi awards. I grew up hearing about it, even though I read a lot of science fiction. I never got around to this one, and I read it the other week basically because it weighs less than Salman Rushdie's Joseph Anton does, and I was looking for a book to carry with me up to New York. In sort of the twin poles of military science fiction, I guess that this is kind of the opposite of Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers. We mentioned the Paul Verhoeven's movie version early in the show. You know, that was a real subversive film in that it kind of parodied the right-wing politics of the novel that went right over my head when I read Starship Troopers when I was 11 or whatever. The Forever War is kind of the, maybe not left-wing, but anti-war answer to that. The author, Joe Haldeman, was a Vietnam veteran who wrote it as soon as he got home. This is a sci-fi novel that deals with time dilation. So as the troops are going off, traveling faster than light to go to these other planets,
sure,
they're aging at a slower rate than everyone back on Earth. And the longer they stay out, the more problems this causes for them. So, you know, eventually the society of Earth is entirely unrecognizable to them and has evolved beyond war by the time they get back. This novel got me thinking about why no one suffers time dilation on Star Trek as a result of all the warping around, and that got me worrying over whether I would ever know the tender touch of a woman.
There you go.
But Joe Haldeman's The Forever War is also making me
happy. Okay, then. Good. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy? We know it's not the tender touch of a woman.
I'm going to leave that one lie. An Adam Sandler and Andy Samberg movie, that is.
Oh.
It's not That's My Boy.
Okay, then.
It is Hotel Transylvania.
Oh, yeah.
Over the weekend, I took my kids. I figured we'd been sitting around watching football, by which I mean I had been sitting around watching football for long enough. And so I gathered up my kids, took them to the movie theater, and this movie is great fun. It's very, very, very much in the spirit of Despicable Me.
Okay.
Thematically, they're almost identical.
Okay.
It's basically the character you would perceive naturally as a villain who is raising a moppet. In this case, more of a teenage girl, but he is incredibly well-meaning, and it does fall into that weird place that virtually every animated movie does, in which mom is dead. It's really, when you think about it, the primary genre in which single dads exist in popular culture.
Animated movies in which mom is dead.
Animated movies in which mom is dead. But it is amazing how many of examples of that there are. Your How to Train Your Dragon, there are so many. Anyway, it's a very, very sweet, fun, charming movie. And the next day, I got a call about wanting to know if Grace wanted to go on a play date, whether she would want to see Hotel Transylvania again. And her response was, yes, 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 yes.
All right, then. Well, good for you, and good for Grace. And when it comes to me, what is making Making Me Happy is something similarly goofy, I have to say. Tickets are on sale now for the Broadway arrival of the musical theater phenomenon Matilda, which has been running in London and having people go insane for it for a little while now.
My mummy says I'm a lousy little worm. My daddy says I'm a bore. My mummy says I'm a jumped up little germ. That kids like me should be against the law.
It's going to be a massive hit in the United States, and it is going to introduce a good many Americans to the raving eccentric that is Tim Minchin, who's a cabaret performer and comedian who wrote the music and lyrics. Performances don't start till March, but you can get the cast album now and fall in love with it right away and buy your tickets before everyone else on the planet buys tickets, and you can't see this for a year. I'm just telling you now. You might also check out Tim Minchin's website, which is timminchin.com, M-I-N-C-H-I-N, where you can see some preview videos from the musical, plus some of his cabaret work, which, as I have said, is passing strange. So that is what's making me happy this week, and that is what brings us to the end of another show. Come and keep the conversation going with us at facebook.com/PCHH, and by all means check in with us from time to time on Twitter. You can follow Linda Holmes at NPR Monkey C, and I am at Trey Graham, that is Trey with an E, and Graham like the lady in the famous Gainsborough painting. Please, for the love of God, follow Stephen Thompson at I Dislike Stephen. That is Stephen with a PH because he really likes the attention.
It's all I have.
You can follow Glenn Weldon at G.H. Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. And Chris Klimek tweets from the Fortress of Solitude that is at C.T. Klimek. That's K-L-I-M-E-K. Our fearless producer, Jess Gittner, is at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. Last but never least is our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, who's at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, is responsible for our in-and-out music, to which, as always, you are tapping your feet this very minute. Thank you so much for being here, guys.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening. We'll see you next week.